Up next, we have our book reading program, Ohomoni Iyotaka, read by Gail Hublin.
The Lakota Way, Stories and Lessons for Living, by Joseph M. Marshall III. Chapter 4, Honor. Wayu o Niha. To have integrity, to have an honest and upright character. The Story of the Snake. The old ones like to say that there are many strange and mysterious things in this world. They knew this to be true because they had seen things, some wondrous, some funny, some powerful or small. But everything has a purpose, they said. Everything that happens is a gift from life itself, if for nothing else than to teach us a lesson. My grandfather told me about some hunters long ago who met something powerful and mysterious and learned a lesson about honor, a lesson they remember each time they saw a snake. Four hunters went into the great mountains we call Baja Sapa, the Black Hills, whose pine-covered slopes look black from a distance. These mountains are important to us because they are so mysterious and powerful, and because the old ones say we came out of the earth through a hole in the ground there, a cave. Today it is called Wind Cave. Hunting was always good in the Black Hills because elk and deer were always plentiful. After a day's travel into the mountains, the hunters made camp in a secluded narrow meadow. There they prepared their weapons and rested. They fell asleep that night, eager for the new day and for good things to happen. Sometime in the night, one of them awoke to add wood to the fire and saw a frightening and terrible sight. A giant snake had encircled them in their camp. The hunter was frightened. He closed his eyes and opened them, but the snake was still there. He woke the others, motioning them to keep silent, and pointed at the snake. None of them had ever seen such a thing. It seemed as though they were all having the same bad dream, and all they could do was huddle together in confusion. As yet, the snake had not moved. "What shall we do?" the youngest of them asked in a whisper. "Perhaps we can kill it with arrows if we all shoot at once." "No," cautioned the oldest. "If we cannot kill it, it will kill us. It has to be very powerful. We must think of a way to escape while it seems to be asleep." They stood around the dying fire, but the moonlight through the large pines was bright, and they could see red and black stripes on the snake. They waited, each of them expecting the thing to disappear because nothing in their lives had prepared them to believe that giant snakes were real. But it didn't disappear, so they had to believe it was real. "We must do something," one of them said. "If it is asleep, it will certainly eat us when it awakens. It could swallow us all easily." Without a doubt it could. Its back was as high as the hump of a buffalo, and it was as long as 20 buffaloes standing in a circle, nose to tail. "There is only one thing to do," the oldest hunter told them. "We must jump over it." All of them were strong and healthy, but none of them had ever had to jump over a giant snake. "We can dig a hole, get in, and cover ourselves," suggested another. "Perhaps it will think we escaped and leave." "The ground is full of stones," said the oldest. "We have no tools to dig such a large hole. We must jump before it awakes." The others yielded to that logic, though not without some misgivings. Clearly the one place to jump over was where the snake's head and tail came together, because it was the lowest spot. "First we must throw our bows and arrows over," said the oldest hunter, who was the leader. "I will go last and you must be first," he said to the youngest. "Take a run and leap over that spot where the head and tail are." "I cannot," whined the young man. "What if I cannot jump high enough, or if I fall?" "It is more than likely certain that the snake is here to eat us," said the leader, "so you must try." He tossed his weapons a good distance into the trees over the snake's back, as did the others. But the youngest was too frightened to jump, so the leader pointed to the next man. "Go, take a run and jump." The man stepped back just beyond the fire as the others moved aside to give him room. Suddenly he dashed forward and jumped, tumbling over the snake's head and into the brush beyond. He landed with a thud and stood, motioning for the others to follow. Encouraged, the next man did likewise, crashing through the brush at the edge of the trees behind the snake. The leader grabbed the youngest hunter by the shoulders. "See," he said, "it can be done. They have jumped and you can too." The young man took deep breaths. "Yes," he said uncertainly, "I will try." Then he stepped beyond the fire, tried not to look at the snake, and ran as hard as he could. He might have made it. His spear had helped him jump so high he would have cleared the snake's back, but he didn't because the snake raised his head and sent the young man crashing back to the ground near the fire. He landed so hard he was knocked out. The two hunters who had already jumped ran and hid in the trees. The leader quickly bent over the unconscious young hunter as the snake raised its terrible head and stared at them with unblinking eyes. There was nothing to be done. The two hunters were at the mercy of something they didn't know existed until that night. Frightened down to the core of his very being, the leader could do nothing but await what might happen. After a long wait, all the while chilled by the unblinking black eyes of the giant snake, he felt the young man stir. Strangely, the snake moved at the same time, crawling off into the dark forest, silently moving through the trees in spite of its size. When it was gone, the other hunters came out of hiding. The youngest one woke and grabbed his head. "I have a terrible headache," he said. "The snake spoke to me in my head." The other two hunters gathered their weapons and strung their bows. "It might come back," one of them said. "If it does, we must fight it." "No," said the youngest, "it will not come back." "What do you mean?" asked the leader. "The snake talked to me inside my head," said the youngest. "It has asked us to do something for him. If we do not, he will find us and swallow us." The others thought for a moment. Perhaps there was something to what the young one was saying. After all, before tonight, none of them would have believed that such a thing as a giant snake was real. So that same giant snake talking to the young man in his head was not difficult to believe. "What did the snake tell you?" asked one. "We must make a journey north by east," he told them, "until we come to a flat river and follow it into a low valley. There we will find a single lodge with a red door. A man lives there with his wife and child, a man with a scar under his eye. He will be expecting us. Two of us must wait with the wife and child while the other two take the man north, keeping north by east across the great muddy river and on until they find a long narrow lake that is not deep. The man must walk across that lake. The snake said if he crosses to the other side, he will be free to return home." "If he does not cross to the other side, what will happen?" the leader asked. "I do not know," replied the young man. "I know only that the man must walk into that lake and try to reach the other side. Whatever happens, we must return to his lodge." They stayed awake the rest of the night, afraid that the snake would return, but it didn't. In the morning, they traveled east, and by sundown, they were out of the mountains. The following sunrise, they headed north by east, and 2 days later, they came to a river and camped. "Are you certain the snake talked to you?" asked one of the hunters. "Could it be that you thought he did? Perhaps it was only a dream." "Was the snake a dream?" asked the leader. "I have never heard of such a thing. Yet I saw it. Am I to think my eyes and ears were lying to me?" "I am only trying to be certain we were not being led into a dangerous thing," replied the first hunter, "or made to look like fools. I, for one, think that traveling into country we don't know, perhaps even into enemy country, because we listened to someone who said a snake talked to him, is laughable." "I have not lied," insisted the youngest hunter. "I told you what I heard. The snake said if we do not do as he says, he will take us all. He will swallow us." "You are free to go," the leader said to the first hunter. "You do not have to believe what this young man says. But remember, we all saw the snake. We all saw what happened to this young man. So I believe him because I don't want a giant snake following me, waiting to swallow me." "If we find the lone lodge with a red door," retorted the first hunter, "then we will know this is all true. If we do not find such a lodge or a man with a scar below his eye, I will go home, back to do something sensible." The next day, after following the river for half a day, they came to a valley. Not too far into the valley, they came upon a lodge in a grove of trees. The lone lodge had a red door. In it lived a man with a young wife and a child. The man had a scar under one eye. The hunters were more surprised to see him than he was to see them, as if he knew they were coming. The man was past middle age with streaks of gray in his hair, and his wife was very young. He showed them a good spot along the river for their camp and lingered to talk. "My wife will have food for you. You must come to my lodge and eat. You have traveled far, and I knew that you would come some day," he told them. "I know also that you have something to tell me." The hunters were reluctant, but they had been given a task. So the leader revealed the purpose of their journey. Two of us are to remain with your wife and child while two take you north by east, across the great muddy river and on to a long shallow lake. It is many, many days' journey, perhaps as much as one moon. When we reach that lake, you are to walk across. If you reach the other shore, you can come home. Yes, said the man with the scar under his eye, I will travel with you. We can leave 2 days from now. I wish to have one more day with my wife and son before I must leave. When you have made your camp, come to our lodge and eat. First a giant snake and now a mysterious man with a scar. The hunters didn't know what to think. For certain they had been drawn into something they knew nothing about, and a long, long journey into unknown territory awaited them. Why must he walk across that lake? Asked one of the hunters as they made camp. Why does he live here with only his wife and child? Asked the second hunter. Was he banished from a village? Only people who are banished live alone. If he is banished, what did he do? Wondered the leader. It was more than likely something very bad. A man is not banished for something minor. The evening meal of elk stew prepared and served by the man's young wife was very good. She was courteous and very shy. Her baby was just now walking and stayed close to his mother after the strangers entered his home. The four hunters were polite guests and were very grateful for a woman's cooking. The talk around the fire was about hunting and about the good late summer weather. Nothing was said about the arrival of the hunters or the news they brought. The evening passed pleasantly, and soon the hunters excused themselves, not wanting to overstay the hospitality of the cozy lodge. They spent the next day resting and making arrows. The leader decided that he and the youngest hunter should accompany the man north, a decision not disputed by the other two. Much of their talk was about the man with the scar under his eye, who as yet offered no explanation for his situation. They sensed that he was a good man, but they also saw a quiet sadness about him. That evening he came to their camp. My wife knows I must make this journey with you, he said. She wants to accompany me. We have not been apart since we became husband and wife. It is hard for her, this thing that I must do, but she will wait as she knows she must. These two will stay, said the leader, pointing to two of his companions. Indicating the remaining hunter, he said, he and I will travel with you because the snake talked to him, and because when I was a younger man, I traveled into that north country. It is the home of our enemies, so we must be careful. I too went north as a young man, said the man with the scar. I crossed the great muddy, but it was in winter. I shall be ready at dawn, and we will go. Once again the man had not given an explanation. You must be cautious, advised one of the hunters who was staying. You will be in enemy country, but more than that, there is something about this that we don't know. It is not good to be blind about anything. At dawn, the three men departed. The young wife stood at the door of her lodge and watched until she could no longer see the travelers. 10 days brought them to the great muddy river. It was late summer and the powerful river was low, though it still took all of their strength to cling to a log and swim with it across to the other shore. After several more days, they were into enemy territory. The flat, wide-open prairie country can make wanderers out of any being, whether it walks, crawls, or flies. The openness, one low hill after another, beckons. The top of one hill lures one to the next to see what is beyond. The three travelers saw great herds of the white-bellied goats, the antelope, and even greater herds of buffalo that covered the land like a great brown cloud. Above them soared the hawks and eagles and the buzzards and ravens. If not for the uncertainty that awaited them at the end of their journey, the joy they felt at being part of the earth would not seem so out of place. Around the evening campfires, the man with the scar had talked easily but revealed little of himself. Nothing at all to point to the reason for the strange journey. As yet he had said nothing of the snake, nor did he ask a question. The only certainty, as the snake had said, was that the man had been expecting the hunters to come to his lodge, and every night he had gone off a distance from the camp to smoke his pipe and pray. In enemy country they traveled more slowly, keeping out of sight in the valleys. 15 days after crossing the great muddy river, they came to a long lake that curved much like a new moon. Though they had passed by several lakes, big and small, they knew this lake was the one. There was something here. The hunters could sense it. And there were no animals and no birds in the sky or near the water. There was only a strange silence. Since entering enemy country, they had made few fires, and now they made a coal camp in a hidden cove at the water's edge. The two hunters were watchful for enemies, yet they knew somehow that none would come. "There is something about this place," the leader said. "There is a feeling here." "Yes," said the young hunter, "the same feeling when I first saw the snake." The man with the scar had spoken not at all since they had found the lake. That evening he went off alone. In a while they could hear him singing his death song. As the moon rose, he returned and spoke to his companions. "Tomorrow, after sunrise, I will walk into the lake as you told me I must do. I think I know what awaits me in the water. If I do not reach the other shore, take my things home to my wife. Be so kind as to see her back to her family. She has been away from them for too long. Ask her also what you want to know about me. She will tell you." So saying, he went away to sit near the water to await the dawn. The two hunters were certain of one thing. The man with the scar on his face was brave. Dawn came and turned into a pale red glow over the east horizon, and the waters of the lake shimmered with the same pale glow. Soon the sun rose over the edge of the earth. The hunters watched as the man with the scar removed his shirt and leggings, standing only in his breechcloth and moccasins. Singing his death song, and without looking back, he entered the water. There was no wind. The lake was calm and flat as though frozen. A strange silence filled the air as the man walked farther and farther into the lake. It was shallow. Even as he drew near to the middle, the water reached only to his thigh. The hunter stood on the shore and watched, hoping and praying that the man would reach the other shore. The width of the lake was more than an arrow could fly from a strong bow, but they could see the other shore. When the man reached the middle, the water rose to his chest. It was then that something happened behind him. There was motion. The water began to move as if boiling. Something dark broke the surface for just a heartbeat. Then the man with the scar on his face was taken under. The hunters ran up and down the shoreline as the waters of the lake once more became calm and flat. It was as if nothing had happened. They knew in their hearts that the man was gone, but they waited, hoping. The morning passed. There was nothing. Only the strange silence. Sadly, they gathered up his shirt and leggings, his bow and arrows and his lance, and began their journey home. 20 days passed before they returned to the lodge with the red door standing in the valley of a flat river. The two waiting hunters were happy for their return. "Some time ago, many days," one said, "she began to weep and gashed her arms in the morning and cut her hair, and since then she has worn ashes on her face." "She knows something," said the leader. "She knows her husband is gone. He did not reach the other shore of that lake. Something pulled him under." The youngest hunter gave the man's belongings to his mourning wife. She took them and thanked him for taking the journey with her husband. They waited for days out of respect for her state of mourning, making sure that she had food and water. One day she finally spoke to them. "I must return to my village," she said. "We will take you there. Your husband asks us to do so, and we will," said the leader. They traveled south by east, and the young widow spoke not at all. Though she cooked for them and would help set up their night camps, she kept her thoughts to herself. After 15 days they came to a large encampment just west of the Great Muddy River, north of where the Big River flows into it. She was welcomed home by her family. The hunters were invited to stay as long as they chose, but they were anxious to return to their homes. They did stay to rest for a few days. On the evening before they were to leave, the young widow came to the hunters' camp. "I must tell you of my husband," she said. "When he was a young man, he had a good friend who became a powerful medicine man. But he turned to the darker side of the powers he had and became a helper for some bad spirits. My husband turned away from him, and in time he became a great warrior and a leader to whom the people turned. The medicine man was jealous of that and used his powers against my husband. He used a special medicine to take my husband's first wife away from him. Even then my husband would not give in, and the medicine man was shamed in front of the people. He went crazy and died that way. A spirit, a bad spirit, came to my husband. He said there was to be punishment, but that my husband had to choose. He could take that shame of banishment, or he could watch his own village go crazy like the medicine man did. My husband chose banishment. The spirit told him that one day 4 men would come for him, but that he would never know when. The spirit wanted my husband to think that every day was his last. He had one other choice. My husband could lift the punishment from himself whenever he wanted, but that meant his whole village would go crazy. How is it that you became his wife? The youngest hunter asked. My father sent me to him, she replied. He told me the story of this brave and honorable man and said that his kind of honor and bravery must not die with him. It must be passed on, and so it has because I have his child. The hunters returned to their own village. When their relatives asked why they had been gone for so long, they would only reply that they had lost their way and made a long journey. But in time, they told the story of that long journey. Some of the people believed it and some did not. Yet over time, it was noticed that the four hunters who shared the journey were the humblest and most honorable men in the village. Perhaps it is difficult to believe in giant snakes, but I have lived long enough to know that there is much I don't know. I can't say for certain that giant snakes don't exist because I have seen many things in my life that may seem unbelievable to some or just normal to others, like a man walking on the moon. But I do know for certain that there are many wondrous, powerful, and mysterious things we may experience in our lives. I hope one of them is honor. The color of honor. A wise man was asked what virtue he would choose if he were to be known by only one. Honor, he replied without hesitation. If I am known for being honorable, it can only mean that I have demonstrated many other virtues. The application of virtue is the positive core of any culture, society, or nation. Like individuals, nations can be kind, generous, truthful, honest, generous, and courageous. Those individuals, cultures, societies, and nations that indiscriminately, blindly, if you will, apply all virtues in their conduct and dealings will establish themselves and emerge as the most honorable. To be honorable is to have integrity, to be honest, and to do what is morally correct. As much as judgment is based on what we do, it is also, and perhaps more indelibly, defined by what we fail to do. A man received as payment more money than he was owed. He kept the extra sum, looking on it as an unexpected reward. But the values he was taught told him that it was wrong to have kept the extra money. For many years he pushed aside that truth, but it remained in his awareness like a pebble in his shoe. Finally, he returned twice the amount of the extra money and was highly commended for it. But he was circumspect and turned aside all the praise. Don't you feel good about your honorable act? He was asked. No, he replied. Returning the money after all these years was merely atonement. Honor was and is important to Lakota culture just as it is to cultures the world over. But to define the traditional Lakota sense of honor, it is necessary to examine Plains Indians' intertribal warfare. It is perhaps incongruous or illogical to speak of honor within the context of warfare and combat, given the terrible efficiency of modern weaponry and the horrific record of wartime atrocities. Any extremely difficult situation demands courage, and war and combat are arguably the most extreme tests of courage. As despicable as war is, it is a saving grace for the human species that most who engage or participate in it endeavor to do so with honor. Honor can be as simple as a ceasefire when the vanquished lay down their arms. It can be as grandiose as General Ulysses Grant allowing the surrendering Confederate soldiers to keep their horses at the end of the American Civil War in 1865. Among the Plains Indian tribes prior to the so-called Indian Wars of the 19th century, honor was often associated with warfare for practical and moral reasons. War is and has been basically the same the world over. If it is defensive action, it is usually to resist encroachment or invasion, imperialism. As an offensive action, it is usually to encroach or invade, which are imperialistic notions. Consequently, a nation or a culture is judged by how and why it engaged itself in war. Intertribal warfare on the pre-European plains of North America was perceived to be rooted in savagery first and foremost simply because the people of the plains were considered to be savages. Savage is as savage does. However, intertribal warfare had a different meaning and purpose than the usual defensive-offensive aspects of imperialistic warfare. It was, in a real sense, an intentional proving ground. Lakota fighting men achieved honors in the arena of combat from courageous deeds and honorable conduct. Armed clashes between enemy tribes were rarely long, arduous campaigns involving hundreds of warriors. They were more often intense, short-lived engagements between small forces of 10 to 50 men. And while it was necessary to protect home, family, and precious hunting territories, warfare as a consequence of outright imperialism was infrequent. More frequent was the provocation of conflict solely to create an opportunity for combatants to conspicuously display deeds of courage and honor. There was one highly significant difference between European-style warfare and Plains Indian warfare. Europeans and Euro-Americans fought to kill as many of the enemy as possible while doing considerable damage to their supplies and support functions. Plains Indian warriors endeavored to demonstrate courage and honor in the face of the enemy, and defeating an enemy didn't necessarily mean having to kill him. Lakota and other Plains warriors considered it far more courageous and therefore more honorable to touch a live enemy in battle and live to tell about it, because that courage and honor were the basis for the strength of a tribe. It was good, strong medicine to have more of both than the enemy, and it was the number and frequency of brave and honorable deeds that served to defeat one's enemy, not the number of dead bodies on the battlefield. Defeating the enemy in his own mind was better than taking his life. The unavoidable consequences of combat were wounds and death, always a clear and present danger. Combat was by no means an easy proving ground. There was, therefore, no higher calling than to defend one's people, no greater sacrifice than to lay down one's life in the defense of one's people. That philosophy was summed up in the reminder from the Antiquities of Memory, spoken by women to their husbands and sons, to go boldly ahead, for it is better to lie a warrior naked in death than to be wrapped up well with a heart of water inside. The words of many warrior songs articulate that quite clearly, such as the following: I go forward under the banner of the people. I do this so that the people may live. The underlying rationale was that if a man was capable of acting bravely and honorably in the midst of the most violent, chaotic, and frightening of circumstances, he was capable of bravery and honor in the time of peace. The benefit to the people was twofold. Their fighting men were totally committed to the defense of families, home, and homeland, and the lessons of courage and honor learned under the most difficult of circumstances would serve to benefit all of the people in any circumstance. Fighting men who gained fame and won honors in the arena of combat achieved high standing in the community. Furthermore, if their leadership under fire led to military successes because of steadiness and wise decision-making, they were sought after for civilian leadership where that hard-won experience could be put to use for the benefit of all the people. In a way, then, warfare was a necessary part of the overall culture, but not in the sense that it was created or used to fulfill a need for violence or aggression. Whether by design or not, a negative aspect of human interaction was used as a vehicle for positive influence. In the very early 1800s, sometime after the various Plains tribes acquired firearms to some extent, a group of enemy raiders, perhaps Pawnee, made an incursion into Sichongo Lakota territory from the south. The southern border then was the Running Water River, now known as the Niobrara River in what is now north-central Nebraska. They managed to advance north nearly to the Smoking Earth Little White River before they were detected and pursued. Badly outnumbered, the only recourse for the raiders was to run back south. A relentless pursuit by Sichongo Lakota warriors wore out the enemy horses and forced their riders to make a stand on a high ground, a pine-covered knoll on a ridge east of the Smoking Earth River. A few of the raiders had been wounded in the pursuit, and they apparently died of their wounds after a defensive position was established. A siege ensued wherein the Sichongo attempted several charges to dislodge the raiders. A Sichongo was wounded and a horse was killed in the futile attempts. During the night, the raiders attempted to break out back and suffered more casualties. The following day saw a series of Sichongo assaults and enemy counterattacks. The Sichongo then decided to wait it out because they had access to water and plenty of food, not to mention reinforcements. In spite of the dire circumstances, the raiders showed no signs of weakness. They defended themselves bravely and skillfully. Both sides knew that it was only a matter of time before the raiders were out of water and food and ammunition for their two firearms. the Sichang who talked of setting brush fires and forcing the enemy from the hill, but it was decided to let the raiders live because they were brave men. The leader of the Sichang who contingent signaled for a parley and then met with the leader of the raiders. Through hand signs, a necessary and effective method of communication used by many plains tribes who couldn't speak each other's language, the offer of clemency was made, likewise the reply. The raiders surrendered their horses and returned for safe passage to the south bank of the Running Water River. Their dead, buried in shallow graves atop the pine-covered ridge, were to be left unmolested. My grandfather told me this story. He also said that war is really a fight between the good and the bad sides of humans. And while both emerge during hostilities, it is within each person to choose to bring out the best or the worst part of himself. In this story, the Sichang, who I'm proud to say, brought out the best part of themselves. Interestingly, and in the mid-1980s, highway engineers digging core samples prior to a new highway construction discovered human bones on a ridgetop a few miles east of the Little White River and 11 miles west of the town of Mission, South Dakota, on the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation. After conferring with the Rosebud Sioux, Sichang Lakota, tribal leaders, and elders, the survey line for the new highway bed was moved and the bones remained undisturbed. There is no conclusive evidence that identifies those bones, but in my mind at least, they are a testament to honor a man's humanity to man. I shudder to think of a society where there is absence of honor. The consequences of such a condition would be confusion, chaos, and anarchy. The fine line we walk was drawn because honor cannot be mandated. Therefore, we are dependent on the ability of individual societies, cultures, and nations to choose between the best or the worst part of themselves. Individual choices can be simple or more complicated. In 1996, in a rural community where we lived, my wife stopped at a convenience store to purchase gasoline. She had only $5 and managed to go 5 cents over her limit before she shut off the gas pump. The attendant in the store, similarly, confiscated her car keys after my wife reported her unintended faux pas. She telephoned to advise me of her predicament and had to wait while I drove to the store to pay the nickel overage. Several months later, we moved to a small community in the Northwest. I purchased a part for my pickup truck at an auto parts store and was a dollar short. The owner, who didn't know my name or my address or my phone number, made up the difference and said I could settle up with him the next time I was in town. A developer hired an architect, his daughter's fiancé, to design a house for a special client. The house needed to be the architect's best effort, the developer said. A statement of design, function, and beauty. Within a few months, the young architect delivered a set of plans to his prospective father-in-law. The man approved the plans and then asked the architect to supervise the construction of the house, giving him complete control and a generous budget. The young man took the job eagerly. The plans he had drawn were the best he had ever produced, and he was anxious to see the house become a reality. He took bids from several construction firms and hired the lowest bidder with the least amount of experience, ignoring the fact that the next lowest bidder had a reputation for completing projects on time and under budget. Next, he went to a local lumber yard and purchased the cheapest building materials, saving money but seriously sacrificing quality. The builder's inexperience resulted in serious structural flaws. Rather than correct them and incur more costs, the architect decided that no one would know the difference once the floors, walls, and ceilings were in place, and he would save money. Outwardly, the house was a showpiece. Though its appearance was aesthetically pleasing, the architect was well aware of its hidden weaknesses, but he was just as convinced that the occupants of the house would never know the difference. The developer arrived with his daughter and accepted the keys to the new house, and praised the young architect for a job well done. Then he turned the keys over to the young couple. It was his wedding present to them. Honor is probably the most difficult virtue to uphold because it requires that one first be honest with oneself. If you can overlook or live with your own dishonor, then it's a simple matter to think that the rest of the world can also. In the old days, a certain warrior society called the Oglelutha Wichapi, or the Red Shirt Warriors, issued only 2 invitations for new members once every 4 years. It was a prestigious club and many wanted to join. But not everyone who was invited was able to pass the test required for membership. It's interesting that those who failed ultimately turned out to be among the most honorable men around. To earn membership in the Red Shirt Warriors Society, each invitee was asked to face a test of endurance. Without food and water and only a knife for protection, he was required to run a particular route to a well-known landmark, a high shale cliff along a river, climb it, and then recover a red sash tied to a stone. This was to be done immediately after the new moon in the middle moon, July, the hottest time of the year. The only other condition was a time limit of 4 days. The two invitees would draw lots to determine who would go first. The prospective member would usually return by sunset of the fourth day, exhausted, hungry, and most of all, thirsty. Before he could take food or water, he was escorted into the lodge of the Red Shirt Warrior Society and asked to present the sash he recovered. In all its history, no prospective member had ever failed to return with the red sash. The sash was rolled tightly, and the man who brought it back was asked to hold it above his head and let it unfurl. If it extended all the way to the ground, the man had gained membership. If it did not reach the ground, he was denied. The test was one of physical endurance, but it was also a test of honor. There were two sashes. One was tied to a stone at the top of the shale cliff, and when it was unfurled from above a man's head, it easily reached the ground. The other sash was tied to a tree located at a point just over halfway along the route, at a place where it was logical to rest briefly in the shade. That sash was shorter of the two. If a man unfurled this sash before the elders of the Red Shirt Warrior Society, it was clearly evident that he had not gone the full distance. Those who returned with the short sash were turned away, and the elders of the society never needed to explain their decision. No one ever received a second invitation to join, but in all its history, the few men who were denied membership into the Red Shirt Warrior Society never failed to demonstrate honor in all their undertakings. In Lakota culture, red is the color of honor. And that concludes Chapter 4.
This program is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to Ohomani Iotaka on KDKO 89.5 FM.